You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you so much for having me. So, I'd like to begin by apologizing to Gil Scott-Heron and to Amanda Lotz from stealing this title. Gil Scott-Heron has a fabulous MP3 that you can get free at the Internet Archive called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, if you haven't heard it. Amanda Lotz wrote a book called The Television Will Be Revolutionized. And my response is, the television cannot be revolutionized. And that is the talk that I have to give you. I'll give you a brief. I used to think that the mass medium of television was defined by a distribution bottleneck. And I thought that if you made that distribution bottleneck go away, then television would change. But, strangely, it doesn't seem to be going away. And there seem to be other bottlenecks that I didn't think of. Search, particularly, and genre, which is a sort of messy one I'm still working out. That's the preview of the talk. What I'd like to get out of this talk is a research agenda for studying these issues empirically. So let me get started and take you back to 1995. In 1995, there's a documentary that I'm basing this on that I love by Molly Fitzsimmons called Puppy Love. I don't know if any of you have heard, but it's the story of her father in 1995 who tried to launch a cable television channel. I don't know if anyone's seen it. No one's seen it. Well, anyway, I recommend it strongly. But her father had this idea for a new cable channel that he called the Puppy Channel, and later he called it Channimals. But the idea was that there was a market out there for a cable channel that only had puppies. It would have puppies 24 hours a day, and later he experimented with the kitten channel and ducklings and some other things. But this was his big idea. And the interesting thing about the documentary is that it gives you a window into what it's like to try and launch a cable television channel in 1995. So he actually maxed out his credit cards, and he commissioned audience studies to make the case for this. And he found, this is going to be may mean more to those of you who watched cable in 1995, but he found that his proposed channel would capture an expected 0.1% of the U.S. audience for television, which is very respectable. He found that it scored better than Court TV and TBS. So this is definitely, he thought, viable as a cable television channel. So how do you go about starting one? Well, he took his case to Barry Diller, and he took his case to Rupert Murdoch, and he took his case to Ted Turner. And the verdict from all of them, and this is a quote from a letter that they sent him, one of them, was that it was too weird an idea for cable. That it wasn't going to work, and they rejected it. And so he, after it was rejected, he decided he would try to just raise the money to pay for cable or satellite carriage himself. And the estimate he got from some consultants for that was that he should, if those three didn't agree, that he should try to raise about $17 million. So that was 1995, and now things are different, right? This is the internet. This is 2010. The distribution bottleneck of television is broken. And in fact, the Puppy Channel, he did launch a website, the Puppy Channel. This is an earlier iteration of it. He's sponsored by Urinoff. So Urinoff is making his dream come true, but largely no one is watching the Puppy Channel. But that's okay, because there's the Kitten Channel, and there's, you know, I Can Have Cheeseburger, and of course the largest Puppy Channel of all is probably YouTube, right? I think that's fair. So this is the internet, and the distribution bottleneck has been broken. So here's the strange thing. Lately, if you've been following developments in the online video distribution industry over the last year, it starts to look a lot more like 1995 than 2010. And I'm sure some of you know what I mean. So just to give you some examples, YouTube is, you know, launched this rentals program, right, and has a variety of new partnership programs. They've put ads on everything that didn't have ads all over it before, almost. I mean, they've really increased their ads and their in-screen ads. They've launched an aggressive campaign to stream sporting events. Their first big success was cricket, maybe not the NFL that they wanted, but still they're trying to get exclusive deals to stream sporting events on the internet. In short, they're behaving something like a television network and not like a tube for you, I guess, would be. So the television columnist and technology writer for the New York Times put this in a way that I like. He says, you know, the internet was thought to be a TV killer, but it's turning out to be more like its wingman. And in fact, if you look at the recent YouTube redesign of the webpage for YouTube, I don't know if anyone noticed it. Big YouTube fans? Yeah, because you came to this talk. Yeah, so the head of user experience for YouTube in online, in public debate about the redesign basically says that one of the motivations is to emulate television more closely. This is the big goal. And so one of the quotes that I like is that, you know, we want you to go into passive mode, to sit back and watch. It's interesting if you're a media scholar, right? Because one of the virtues of the internet, and YouTube particularly, one of the reasons we valorize it against television is interactivity. But television, remember, has interactivity as well. You can change the channel. It doesn't seem like much, right? But there it is. You can change the channel. And television, you know, evolved these practices to prevent you from changing the channel that, you know, Raymond Williams, you could say, called flow. This idea that, you know, the way that programs are interspersed with commercials and the way that teasers are made is designed to prevent you from ever thinking of changing the channel or to preempt you from changing the channel because that would cost the station money, right? So my worry that prompted this talk is that this is also what seems to be happening with YouTube. It looks a lot like television. Now, I don't know at this center that I need to make this argument, but just to be safe, you know, video is important to think about, not just because you like cute kittens and maybe you want to watch Chanimals, I don't know. There was a fascinating study last year by paid for by Nielsen, but done by Ball State University, where they used this rather different and more sophisticated approach to audience tracking, where they tried to see what audiences did, not using sort of static categories that had been dominating previous research, like do you do television or internet, right? Which is increasingly a confusing dichotomy, right? And so they actually had people, for most of the studies, shadow people in their daily lives. And there's a lot of methodological problems with that, but it's also an interesting thing because it's such a differently designed study than others in this space. And they did this thing where they tried to capture, you know, what people in the United States spend their time doing with media, and they also looked at media non-exclusively, which is very important because, as the industry calls this, multi-screening is increasingly the norm. So to look at this graph, you see that 100% of the people in the study use the phone every day, and they use it for about, oh, I didn't label that axis, but maybe, I don't know, 50 minutes, it's 45 minutes, quite a bit. And then audio is like way out there on the right. But video, just to remind you, I think people forget these statistics sometimes. You know, video is, we're looking at six hours a day in the United States. I mean, some statistics will tell you it's more like 5 hours, right? But one of the reasons this study is interesting is it was trying to capture whether you did the video on your phone or whether you did the video on the internet or whether you did the video at the couch or whether you did it on the computer, and to all call all of these things video. And so the argument in the study, or one argument, is that that video is shifting to a different carrier, but it's not that people are actually watching less video. They're just watching more YouTube. So again, I probably don't need to make this case here in this audience, but just in case, I mean, YouTube has been estimated last year at being about 2/3 of the video views of all video on the internet. Hard to say if that's still the case because Hulu is becoming more and more popular, right? But last year they had this big scandal with their with a lot of financial analysts who said in reports that were widely publicized that, you know, YouTube was this terrible buy because Google bought them, and that, you know, they're spending $1 million a month in bandwidth, they're losing $1.4 to $1.6 million a day, they spend more than a dollar per visitor, the amount that they sell advertising for per 1,000 impressions is extremely low compared to, say, Hulu. And Hulu in 2010 is reportedly profitable. So you see this, and the analysts, actually, in some language that was fascinating, said the solution is to dump amateur content. You know, this is what you should do. You should sign licensing deals and get rid of this amateur stuff. No one wants to advertise against it. It's too weird. Remember that? All right. No one wants to advertise against it. And, you know, if you could at least try a subscription model, try to get some premium content, and then, you know, that's the route to profitability. So there's some other arguments about why Google might want YouTube, despite the fact that it's not profitable, about peering, but I'm not going to talk about that. We can talk about it in the questions if you want. Okay. A brief moment of historical comparison. This is the link that I sent with the talk abstract. So Dan Schiller and I wrote an essay, and this idea for the comparison is entirely his, comparing YouTube to Life magazine. So Life magazine failed as a weekly magazine in late 1972. It was promoting this new thing called photojournalism and photo essays that was a kind of exciting thing at the time with other magazines like Look, Coronet. And it was very popular. When it went under, it was pioneering photojournalism as a new form. Its circulation was rising. I don't know the circulation figures, but it had several million people, and it was on the increase. And then it failed because its audience was not demographically appealing to advertisers, and so it was closed. So we made this comparison. We actually wrote this a year ago, so now it looks very out of date, but we made the comparison that this is YouTube's situation a year ago, is that the non-traditional content might be popular, you know, the baby videos, the evolution of dance, the kittens, right? But that this doesn't seem to be, you know, the advertisers and the financiers don't seem to be happy with it. Things have changed slightly since then, but anyway. That was the argument a year ago. And so since then, YouTube has responded by becoming ever more like Hulu. And they've tried to change the kinds of video that they host to make it more like old television circa 1995. Now, it's difficult to talk about distribution bottlenecks without talking about this graph. So let's talk about this graph. You know the graph I'm going to put on this, I think. I think you know. Yeah, right. Some of you are smiling, so maybe you know, right? So, so if you, on one axis, on the vertical, if you put the audience for something, which could be linking, it could be hits, it could be watching, it could be reading, it could be something. And on the other axis, you put the sources, could be websites, could be TV channels, could be books. And these graphs, when they're used in research, actually are pretty sloppy, because sometimes they are probability distributions, and sometimes they are lists where each item of content has a spot on the x-axis. And those are actually different graphs. But anyway, there's been a lot of talk for about the last 8-10 years, by some people in this room, in fact, about the fact that this conforms to what's called a power law distribution. Now, depending on what kind of research you're doing, you might recognize a zip distribution, or you might say it's Pareto distributed. You know, if you're Robert K. Merton doing early work on scholarly publishing, then you say, oh, look, you know, there's an 80-20 rule with scholarly publishing, and, you know, a small number of sources get all of the citations. So just in case some of you are looking at me blankly, so just to ensure that you're not left out, if we wanted to do this for movies, we might say that Avatar is one source. There's a small number of sources with a large audience, and that might be Avatar, and then there's a large number of sources with a small audience, maybe the video we're making now in this room, although it's not for sale. So that's the argument behind this distribution. Chris, and the shape of it varies by industry and by actually what distribution you're using, but we're not going to go into it too much. But, you know, and Chris Anderson popularized this with the phrase the long tail, right? This is what the internet does, is it provides access to the stuff on the right, whereas before that wouldn't be economically viable. I mean, mainly he says because of shelf space constraints, right? So this is important to talk about, right? So if we want to pull away from this empirical sort of characterization of audience and popularity and look at how people are thinking about this theoretically, this is not a really great way to think about distribution, although it is a way that it's often thought about. So if we think about what would be the normative line that I should draw on this graph, like if I wanted a particular kind of culture or a particular kind of internet or television, what would I draw? And it's very hard to answer that question. It's really not clear. I could say I don't want a dot at the upper left and nothing else. That would be like the Kim Jong-il distribution. There's one thing and everyone watches it, right? That would be bad, I can say that. I wouldn't want, depending again if it's a probability distribution or a list, it would be either a really, really flat line along the bottom or a dot on the lower right corner. I wouldn't want that either. That would be, I produce media and you watch it. And you produce media and you watch it. And none of us share any media at all. So we know that would be bad because none of us would be able to talk to each other about things. And so so in fact, the distribution is interesting. The way it's written about among different disciplines is quite different. So in people writing about the internet see this as diversity and they see it as good. That's great. The longer to the right it goes, the better. It's fantastic. Let's have more of that. People writing in media studies see this fragmentation. They say, oh no, this is terrible. And many distinguished, you could see this like Joe Chiro, or you could talk about Todd Gitlin, or you could talk about Elihu Katz, and so, okay. And similarly, if you look at the head, the things on the left, you could say, oh no, it's concentration. There's so few things and everyone's watching them. It's terrible. Or you could say, it's important, you know, it's shared experience. It's really, we have to have shared experience in order to have conversations, in order to be a community, in order to have a culture. We have to have things that are shared, so, right. That was a digression, but I think the important point to get out of this in terms of the distribution bottleneck for internet video, so for internet video, you could say there's a small number of videos, say on YouTube, but also on Hulu or also on television that most people watch, and there's a lot of videos that a few people watch. But you know, these distributions are used in a variety of areas. If you were using them for income inequality, for example, you could say income inequality is distributed in this way. What you would be doing is a kind of stratification analysis of income. Like some people make a little, most people make a little, few people make a lot. But you wouldn't want to do just a distribution analysis. You would want to do a distribution analysis and a mobility analysis. Mobility. I don't understand why people aren't thinking about this more, and maybe it's just I'm reading the wrong people. But what I'm saying is that the shape of the curve is really difficult to argue about normatively, but whether you can move up it or not is much easier to argue about normatively, right? So remember Chanimals, right? If the way you move up the curve is you have that scowling Ted Turner face, and he has to like what you have, then you could make a sort of process argument that maybe that's not the ideal process for reaching a large audience. You know, if this one person gets to decide, that doesn't seem like good. So this is, right, and this is research that largely isn't done. So my observation, I guess, about the distribution bottleneck is that we seem to be in the process of building two internets right now, which is worrying. So earlier I mentioned that YouTube looks more like Hulu, but you know, if you look a little more behind the scenes, this is the distribution bottleneck reappearing. If I want to put my baby video online on Hulu, on YouTube. Hulu wouldn't want it, but it's pretty straightforward how I would do that. In fact, I wouldn't really have to use YouTube, right? I could just put it on my web server under my desk or something, and it would be fine. There are a bunch of services that do this as well, not just YouTube, right? So that's fine. That's the way that works. But if I want to, this is Michael Phelps. If I want to show the Olympics, and it's going to have a really big audience because of the way that we've set up the internet, or I guess the internet has evolved. You know, NBC needs to enter into some agreement with an edge cache or a content distribution network or some sort of intermediary that will distribute Michael Phelps in such a manner that it'll work. If you tried to do Michael Phelps from the computer under your desk, it wouldn't work for a number of reasons. One of the most important one is that you would get source congestion. You would get, even though I have the bandwidth to watch the video once on my cruddy DSL line, you don't have the bandwidth to share it 10,000 times simultaneously, right? So you get this source congestion, and that's why we have this emergence of networks like Akamai, and I'll talk more about that in a second, right? So so the way that you distribute videos that are not popular and the way that you distribute videos that are popular is very different. It's interesting, again, break for history, because you know when Adorno was getting exercised about the culture industries, what these theorists had done is they had gone and they'd said, gosh, it's so interesting that there are these factories of culture emerging. There are these places like this RCA television station in 1936 that have industrialized cultural distribution to such an extent that you or I can't really access it. And what we need is, you know, a critique, an industrial culture critique. But, you know, it looks like a Google data center if you squint. This is the bootleg video of data center that came out last year from Data Center Knowledge, right? It looks a lot like the Google data center. So there's an ecology. Last year, this was more in play than this year because there was a sort of a pricing war between content distribution networks. But there's an ecology of companies that now make money guaranteeing availability for video of large audiences. And by and large, you can't use them because they won't accept your video unless you are a large enough producer. There's one exception, maybe two, but by and large, you can't. So you need an intermediary like YouTube that will either use one of these services or be one. And they have data centers distributed around the world to host this video and to provide it reliably. So what I'm saying is that television stations were the edge caches of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So this is an important point. I'll explain why. So, and we're recreating that network with video on the internet. Yeah. So one of the problems with the observations of these power laws when we talk about distribution, when we say that there's a small number of videos, say, or actually many kinds of sources that have a large audience, is that in television anyway, in video, this head to this distribution was built. It's not something that was organic in some way or natural. So if we look at television, the stuff sort of the left was after 1962. There's a great article that I want to recommend to everyone by Jonathan Stern about the distribution infrastructure for television and how it worked, how it evolved. And he says, look, now we think of television as being this thing. The defining characteristic is this huge audience, the mass audience of television. But, you know, in early television, what? You didn't have videotape and you didn't have networks that would connect the stations together. You didn't have a huge audience. It wasn't a national audience for television because that was impossible. You had some people that thought that was the way to go, and you had other people that thought that was not the way to go, that local was really the way to organize the media system. And after huge amounts of investment and a lot of lobbying by AT&T, among others, to build and then dominate this television distribution infrastructure, after 1962, you get a national television system, and it was largely constructed to satisfy advertisers. You see the circularity in the argument. We're back to YouTube, right? So even if you like or dislike the head, it's not something that sort of arises naturally, necessarily, out of the internet or out of video. It's something that can be built, and it can be built again. I mean, one of the axiomatic reasons why we think about the internet video as different from television is that the internet is supposed to be cheaper, right? Which is, it's supposed to provide all kinds of economies of distribution. It's not as clear that it does. As a thought experiment for this talk, I tried to use a content distribution network that would accept content from me. So the Amazon Web Services has a CDN that individuals can actually subscribe to, and it's one of the few ones. So Akamai, they generally won't, because you have to have a minimum amount. But if I just want to distribute one video to a million people, and I want to use the internet versus television, what do the costs look like, one versus the other? It's impossible to compare these two things. I mean, if you have experience in television, you'll know, or the internet, you'll know why. But generally speaking, they're not hugely different. I mean, one reason it's hard to compare them is that prices on television bundle together finding the audience, right? So whenever you pay for television, like an ad or even an infomercial, you're including the cost of the audience. So you're not paying a high amount for a Super Bowl commercial because it's 30 seconds long. You're paying for it because you know people are going to be watching the Super Bowl, right? Whereas if you pay for a CDN, a content distribution network like Amazon, your job is to drive traffic to the URL. They're not going to do that for you. So it's somewhat difficult to compare them. But generally speaking, I mean, I thought, well, what if I compare, like, I don't know, an infomercial late at night where there's a potential national audience, but I would have to drive audiences to that somehow late at night, and Amazon Web Services, where there's no expectation that I would have the audience. you know, they're actually not that different. I mean, distributing something like a 2 minute or a 1 minute video late at night to no audience or on Amazon Web Services, you know, the amount that you would pay is considerably close to the same. Like, it depends again on the audience, but that surprised me. It partly has to do with the advertising crash of last year, though. So my point in raising this distribution bottleneck is to say that as someone in the media studies department, I'm fascinated that more people aren't doing research on this, because you do see a lot of talk about the distribution, not so much about the mobility, and you don't see a lot of awareness of infrastructures like content distribution networks. Partly, I think, because there isn't the expertise in departments where people care about media for people to also care about things like infrastructure and how the guts of the internet work and protocols and things like that. I'd like to talk now about my two other emerging, bottlenecks, but I'm just going to talk about them very briefly. One, recall, is search. And this is not actually that surprising. I mean, in some way, the fact that search is a bottleneck, if you wanted to put an academic's name next to it, you know, you could list any number of economists. Internet specifically, you know, this is in some way a follow-up to the Introna and Nissenbaum article from 8 years ago about the politics of search that was very ahead of its time and its thinking. But just to cover this bottleneck in video, if you had a video and you wanted to distribute it, you know, how would you drive traffic to it? It's becoming very clear that the way that videos become popular depends quite a bit on featured placement on homepages, particularly of YouTube, right, and other video distribution sites, and also with recommender systems. Like, this is what you get at the end of a video that says, you might also like these other videos. It's interesting because people, like Chris Anderson, for example, in the popular press, has written about recommender systems as systems that can drive traffic to the obscure, that can democratize distribution of content, because they can find something that Joe Turow is they call like your particular niche, and they can help you find that when you wouldn't be able to find it yourself. I'm puzzled by this, because there's no reason that you would expect these algorithms to do that unless that was the sort of way you were optimizing the algorithm. You could just as easily design the algorithm so that it would push recommendations toward things that would make you more money. So now you have YouTube that's been signing licensing deals left and right, and it's promoting more and more, say, music videos and partner videos on its featured pages link. So we don't know what algorithm YouTube is using, but we have some ideas. I mean, Google Labs doesn't publish much about this kind of stuff, but if you read the computer science literature about recommender algorithms, you get guesses that, in sort of parentheticals, that of course these algorithms use heuristics like featured videos, which are not machine generated. So featured videos on YouTube may be videos that a licensee or someone like Viacom, well, I think Viacom pulled their videos off of YouTube now, but someone like Viacom has worked out this deal so that if you watch a video from them on YouTube, you know, their YouTube is going to make more money. So there's also an interesting reverse engineering community among people who use YouTube a lot, and they've tried to figure out how the recommender algorithms work. And there's some interesting insights there. I mean, one that I'm particularly taken with, is Stephen Witten's, who in 2009 found that the algorithm tends to match view counts, so that if you look at a video that's not popular, it will recommend videos that are also not popular or more popular. So it will never recommend videos that are less popular. Yes? It's actually a YouTube enthusiast more than a researcher. It's a guy with 12 million page views that wants to figure out how the algorithms work, right? Because he wants more page views, and now he's launched a company about that. But it's Stephen Wittens, W-I-T-T-E-N-S. It's certainly possible to optimize the algorithm so that you only get the content from favored media companies. We don't know if that is actually happening. It looks like, at least, there's no reason to suspect the algorithm is democratizing in itself, particularly when we don't know what it is. So now I'll just say a word, because I'm about to wrap up my time here. I'm going to say a word about this third bottleneck that is very mushy and fuzzy and messy, but I'd love your help with, and that's genre, the genre bottleneck. So it may be that I'm naive when I think about video on the internet, and that I was foolish to think that something would happen when the distribution changed. I mean, something did happen, like vlogging and sort of all kinds of interesting pratfall videos on Failblog. I mean, so we did get sort of new kinds of content on the internet when the distribution bottleneck was broken. You could say it's the same thing that, you know, Alan Funt was doing, or that, what's his name, that did America's Funniest Home Videos for so many years. Bob Saget, yeah. So you could say that it's not actually that new, but anyway, I mean, there are some things going on that are slightly different. I mean, one of the things that's puzzling to me, though, is that the way you think about, if you think about this again in terms of mobility, like how do things that are not popular become popular? I mean, if it's not Ted Turner gives it the thumbs up or the thumbs down, it's interesting that so much of what is happening on YouTube does seem to ape the conventions of existing media so closely. I mean, I'm not sure what I expected. People often complain that YouTube is weird, but it doesn't look that weird to me. I don't know if my perspective is wrong or what, but a lot of the things that have, particularly that have been successful, so again, we're talking about things that move up, are parodies of television sitcoms, right? And television sitcoms, or that structure of a 30-minute, now like 18-minute with the ad show, you know, it is certainly, it's been sort of naturalized, but there's nothing natural about it. It's a particular artifact of the way the television evolved, and there's no reason why, if you could make whatever video you want, you would make something that looks like a newscast or that looks like a television sitcom, except, of course, that you would get your audience. It would be recognizable to your audience that's already familiar with those conventions. So the third bottleneck is that, you know, if we look at mobility, it seems to be the matter quite a bit if the things that can move up are different or the same than the things that are already exist. So it matters quite a bit what kinds of things they are. I mean, again, to use the income example, if, for example, there is mobility but only for one kind of group, so there's mobility if you're white but not if you're black, then that would be important. So if there's mobility for things that look a lot like television formats that already exist, then YouTube is just like the A&R of the television industries. What it's done is it's externalized the development of new talent to, you know, amateurs. So this is Mark Andreevich's argument as well. So it's basically that, you know, rather than commissioning all these expensive pilots, they just look around for out-of-work actors making YouTube videos and then commission them, which is something that they've done some of, right? So this is one model for television, but again, it's not necessarily... again, partly, I suppose, because of my naivete, what I expected would happen, right? So, excuse me. So just one more point on genre. If I were doing a talk about news on the internet or public affairs programming or video of that sort, it would be a very different talk, right? Because it's easier to make normative arguments and to find examples of particular videos to valorize. So Adorno famously said that you know, the products of mass culture are in some way interchangeable. So if you have one pop song or, say, you know, boy band, and you have another boy band, it's hard to make an argument why one should succeed against the other, because in some way you could argue they're interchangeable. Similar maybe with the kittens that we saw earlier. It's hard to say, like, that this Viacom-sponsored kitten is better than this other sort of organic grassroots kitten. I don't know. But if you're writing about news and public affairs, you have some great examples. I mean, you have your, like, Nida Sultani video, where you can take an example of something that, you know, may not have gotten out on its own, although, you know, that was picked up immediately by all of the news outlets, so it's hard to use that particular example. But you have examples of politically relevant and important public affairs programming that might get out this way and wouldn't get out some other way, whereas it's not clear that you have that for YouTube. On my blog, when working on this idea, I had a tongue-in-cheek contest called What's the Most Virtuous YouTube Video? So is there a video on the YouTube that would fit this bill that was entertaining or informative, but not in the spirit of news or public affairs? I mean, I got some interesting suggestions. One of them is a video called... So my criteria was it had to be popular. So is there something you could identify on YouTube that was like the photojournalism of Life magazine, something that had become very popular that... was not like what existed elsewhere. And so this is my favorite example that was submitted to me. It's a video by an autistic child trying to explain autism, and it's a very interesting video. I'm going to say more about it. So, okay, that's the third bottleneck. So, all right. So the reason I'm here talking about this, as I said in the introduction, is that I'm surprised that television seems to be evolving backwards. It seems to be going back to some of the conventions in the past rather than in the future in many dimensions, but particularly the ones that I've identified. In each of these three areas, there are some suggestions I have about how you might do research about this to see if it's really happening, because at the moment, a lot of this is at the level of anecdote and suspicion rather than something that we have really well-designed studies about. And there are policy suggestions in each area as well. I mean, distribution, to give you an example there. So there are ways around edge caching. So there's not a particular reason why you would need to have a content distribution network owned by Akamai that would be required to distribute video. We can distribute video other ways. I mean, there's some great projects. There's one at Princeton that does distributed peer-to-peer edge caching, basically. So you can donate bandwidth, but you don't need to be in a subscriber to Akamai in order to have videos that are popular. So there are ways around this, but largely I think these are not getting very much attention. In search, there's also a thriving debate. I mean, my favorite commentator on this is probably Frank Pasquale, who's a law professor who has made some very daring suggestions about the need to expose algorithms if you're going to argue about the goodness or badness of these algorithms for recommendation on many dimensions. He's written about that. I'll just refer to him there. On genre, I'm less sure. I mean, one answer on genre that I've gotten is that it may be that what we need are, it may be that we are seeing, you know, that the channimals or vlogging or video game commentary is the new genre pioneered by YouTube, and that we're too conservative to see it. That, you know, in a few years, YouTube will be seen, like Life magazine, as the pioneer of what us fussy conservatives who remember television saw as weird and odd. But then in a few years, it'll be all Modern Warfare 2 commentary videos and laughing babies, right? And there's some suggestions in that direction, like the network that you may have seen in your hotel, the DND, or Do Not Disturb TV network, which is like the reverse of YouTube. It takes video from the YouTube in the YouTube sort of genres, and it puts it in a television format on television. And then I'd love your comments about my worries. Thank you very much. Yeah, you were first.
Okay. In terms of search, Google's mantra has always been the user experience is the thing that should be put first, and it would be kind of unheard of for Google to accept money to place a search site at the top of the search results or to drive traffic to sites that had AdWords. Do you think Google is essentially doing something like that with YouTube, or do you think that they're just giving users what they want? Do you think they just think, well, the featured video is a premium content, that's what users want to see, so we're improving our user experience by driving users there?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the reasons the debates in this area are somewhat confusing to me is that people can be taught what to want. And it's really important to keep that in the forefront of your mind when arguing about it. So it's hard to distinguish the situations that you're describing. I mean, for example, I would say that YouTube has the right to do whatever it wants with its featured videos thing, you know, on the top page, which, you know, usually has some topical ones and maybe a music video or something, which is usually through a partnership agreement with a major media company, right? So you could say, well, they should be able to do whatever they want with that. So it does seem that though that produces popularity because it's right up there in the front, and then once it's got some popularity, their search algorithms may reinforce it. I mean, in a way, what you're asking is there like a specific variable in the algorithm that we could find that's the one we can point to, perhaps in a court, I'm not a lawyer, and say, look, this one is the one that says if Google makes more money on this plus one.
Right.
But even if they don't have that variable, we might still have the same dynamic, is my point. Right? So it's hard to differentiate your two positions. Google means well but reproduces old television. Google is evil but reproduces old television. Can be done, you know, both can be done.
That would be the smoking variable, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the smoking gun?
Smoking variable.
Oh.
It's a good name for a paper.
The smoking variable.
Yeah. So, or a rocket.
It's very compelling
presentation, but I'm struggling a bit with the dichotomy you set up, mm-hmm. in that television is still ongoing and is still transforming. Mm-hmm. So it seemed a little bit false to say, here's television, and I'm just going to stop the timeline whenever it's convenient for me, mm-hmm. and compare it to the internet. Now, I mean, if you think about it, there's more channels than they can find content mm-hmm. for on television. Television is migrating to the internet. Why not see this as a convergence where the two are shaping each other, mm-hmm. rather than saying, why does the internet look like television did 20 or 30 years ago?
Right. Because
television doesn't look like it did 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I had the privilege of watching a panel where the late James Carey debated Bob McChesney and about media concentration. And Bob McChesney made a very convincing argument about media concentration. And then James Carey said, I remember when there were two channels or three channels, and the news was read by someone who was required to smoke a cigarette, a Camel cigarette, during the news and mention that. So it looks great now. I don't understand. I have a hard time understanding this concentration. So you're right. I mean, I admit that in the framing of this, I have emphasized a question of internet exceptionalism when maybe it's not warranted. To be fair, I think, you know, this is the venue for internet exceptionalism. If we're going to have a talk about internet exceptionalism, here we are, ground zero, right in this room. So I don't know. I think that's...
But we might observe from this that there is a natural tendency mm-hmm. that both media are converging to, where people want a fair density of mass hits that mm-hmm. everyone can talk about, and also want a very, very long tail and a place in that tail where we can put our own content. And television's moved that way partly in response to the mm-hmm. breaking of the distribution.
So I agree. I mean, I think actually your point is more about the framing of the talk than the argument, because in my point about this distribution, I mean, I'm saying, look, we can't normatively reason about the shape very well. There's just not really the tools for that. But we can reason about mobility. And so this is where more research should focus. And as far as I know, it's not. So does that pass your... Okay.
Well, I guess it would be more balanced if you talked about television in the contemporary light as well, because it may be that there's more mobility on television than there was, partly as afforded by the internet.
That's true. I am judged and found guilty of sensationalism. But, I mean, so I won't defend myself further. Ergo.
You haven't really talked about marketing, because that makes a big difference whether you are in the right-hand or the left-hand side of the curve. So for any given network, the biggest advertiser is the network itself.
Yeah.
So now that started to change. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, YouTube is kind of like MTV. It isn't producing its own content. It's merely distributing it. Mm-hmm. And another big thing that makes a difference is the revenue that YouTube generates. There isn't like incentives. Mm-hmm. For most of the amateur producers or small producers in the tail to rise up further in the to the head. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how do you see a change there, the whole marketing issue?
Yeah, I mean, so this is obviously a way that capital is required to gain popularity, right, via marketing, because this is actually a important way that we find things to watch, right? I mean, there are other avenues. Word of mouth and funny YouTube links that people send around, but you know, marketing is crucial. I think I'll just agree with you and say, I mean, the interesting thing that I'm trying to highlight is more that we've also somewhat unintentionally made capital requirements for distribution. I mean, I understand that there are capital requirements for marketing, but I'd like an internet where I could have a video that no advertiser would support. And that there would be a way to host it without it being, you know, hugely expensive. But maybe this is ridiculous. I mean, we had these discussions before in your talk, actually, and when we had the people from public radio talking in this room.
Why would you want to be popular? Have you thought about that?
Because, a key component of the tail that is often not discussed is that as the values get smaller, I mean, in some ways, this is not Anderson or someone celebrates this as your perfect niche, but you could also say it's total irrelevance. And so the reason that mobility is interesting is that you want the, you know, you want an overall argument about the diversity of the media system to say that culture is something that everyone has access to constructing, not just people that have signed a distribution deal with YouTube, right? So that's the reason, right? And if your audience is low enough, it's hard to make that case to say that, you know, I've created my perfect niche of four people, and I am producing the culture of the future for four people, right? So. Yes.
What about BitTorrent? Because it seems that it's the tool you just described. It's the tool where, you know, you can basically put your video and then it's going to be peer-to-peer and people will be able to download it. You know, and you can have like millions of viewers.
So this is the thing. I didn't put it in the talk, but I almost did. So any peer-to-peer algorithm has this problem in that it tends to have performance characteristics that very closely mirror something like PageRank. I mean, the video or the audio that is going to give you the best performance on a peer-to-peer distribution network is going to be popular, right? I mean, and this is like a homework assignment. Take your most obscure musical taste and find some, go on to views and find some of it. I mean, it depends on how obscure your tastes are, I guess. But I mean, generally, you can use BitTorrent efficiently to find things that are very popular in other countries or very popular among some other large group, because the seeds will be around and people will have that on their hard drive and you'll be able to find it. But there isn't, again, the mobility argument. There isn't this way that it's clear that you can use. So this is actually a problem that some of the researchers doing content distribution from a peer-to-peer perspective have encountered, is that you're using a content distribution network when you have unpopular content actually doesn't work very well at first, because you're just adding a bunch of overhead, right? So it starts to be more efficient when you have a bunch of people that already have it, right? So a lot of the people who have written about this distribution before have said that peer-to-peer is the solution to this, but I mean, I think if you look at the popular downloads or the things that are shared on peer-to-peer, it's true that it's under the user's control. But the popularity is hugely determinative of what is efficient to distribute via BitTorrent.
But that's what you want to some extent, no? You want to have increased bandwidth for those videos that are popular, low bandwidth for those videos that are not popular.
But as long as there's a route, so we don't really have the route now. I mean, maybe looking at it from an individual perspective, let's say mythically that I have a video. Let's say that this video that we're recording right now becomes popular. So there's this beginning gap that there's really no way to handle. I mean, if I put it on my web server, I mean, my ISP is going to screw me right after I hit the bandwidth cap, and I'm going to start getting charged for it. That's not going to work very well. If the video is antithetical to advertisers or makes controversial uses of fair use, I'm not going to have a third party for that. If I put it on a peer-to-peer network, I incur a performance penalty because it's not popular yet. So I think that answers your question.
At some point, I, as a nominal moderator, I do want to, at some point, cold call Yohai, but I thought I'd give him a little, warning, that's all. Okay. Sorry.
You're in the queue, but I don't know what the queue is. Okay, wait, could you hold your hands up a little higher? Yeah, so I know you had your hand up in the corner.
Just on this topic of two internets, and there was another speaker. He spoke about demand media a number of months ago, which is kind of mind-blowing in a way. People are familiar with it. They get 2.5 million views a day on YouTube for what people call robo-content. They've kind of gamed algorithms to figure out what people are searching for and create content accordingly, but it's stuff like, how do I get mildew off my shower curtain? So it's the anti-Wikipedia in a way. And I started thinking about this idea, could we possibly be going back to CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy type model where we paid, but the content was good. You know, is there any research or thinking on that topic?
I think actually normatively, if we paid for it, there are a lot of advantages, actually. Because, I mean, you could say what we have now with video distribution on the internet is a sender mostly pays system, which is what requires these edge caches. or these third parties. And again, there's not really necessarily a reason why that has to be that way. And if you had, say, an example I gave earlier in the talk, if you had an easy-to-use rentals program or something like that that would allow you to get distribution cheaply without advertising, then this might actually solve many of the normative problems. I mean, the funny thing is, it's not as it's not quite as cheap as you would expect, and it's not clear because of one of the aspects of these markets that I'm sure everyone knows as well as I do is that if everyone else is giving it away, it's going to be very difficult for you to pioneer the norm of charging for it.
Right, and in that way, the utopian vision, wonderful as it is or was, kind of screwed things up.
Yeah,
everything is free scenario.
Right. Well, I mean, going back to Jason, I guess you had this in television as well, like the sort of the HBO model, it's not that it's completely discontinuous. So maybe we'll see something like that. Yes, you, sir.
How much do you think the culture of the users matters compared to the culture of the distributors? And what I mean is really, right now it seems like people who are uploading videos to YouTube, for example, don't really take into account that they're going to have certain recommended views or certain related videos. So once users start to realize that and try to game the system, do you think that we'll see a convergence of the genre search algorithm that you're just talking about? So I could foresee, like, baby videos, for example, saying in their title, baby video, just so that it wouldn't link to content that would be monetized.
Right. And that's a great point. And in fact, I think as a research method, one of the best ways to find out about these algorithms, rather than reverse engineer them yourself, is to look at people who use YouTube a lot or another service, because they are trying to figure out, look at the search engine optimizers, and they're telling you the evolution of the algorithm because they're testing it over and over again and trying to figure out how to optimize for it. So I think those communities already exist. I mean, maybe they're not large, but they already exist, absolutely. I mean, when you say the culture of the users uploading versus the culture of distributors, that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but I'm sort of provisionally like it. I mean, it may be so. For example, in media research, there's a bunch of stuff that says that when we have a new medium, one of my favorite examples is the telephone and the telegraph. The executives, the business executives, were trained and socialized in the previous medium, and they often carry forward assumptions that may not fit very well. And so there's a great work by Claude Fisher, historian, about the telephone that talks about how the telephone executives were sort of relentlessly trying to organize their business as a telegraph, despite all evidence that it wasn't actually going to work that way. So they had campaigns to encourage people not to talk on the phone for pleasure and other things like that. So it's interesting to think about the culture. I mean, I guess you would argue that, maybe Google has a different sort of business culture than some of these other, some of the more old traditional television industries. That's an open question. I mean, I think, so Amanda Lotz, in her book, The Television Will Be Revolutionized, focuses, I think, sort of excessively on the old understanding of the media industry. And I think an interesting question that I don't see in her book, but I'd love to hear her thoughts on, is what if you have a new industry that is trying to, it's a different actor. So they look, how would a television executive think about this? Or what is NBC up to, is sort of the MO. And then another way is to think, well, what if you're open to some lateral moves? I mean, this is a question, maybe we should get some Google executives in here and grill them. I don't know. So. Yes.
Okay. So the always, content is going to flow uphill toward money. Money's going to warp everything, right? And you've got a lot of executives who have mindset and inertia built into the business model they currently have. Those factors need to enter into your research. And I think also that TV is moving toward the internet. It's not just change the channel anymore. It's, record what I like because I can browse the shows I like. I can time speed through the commercials, and suddenly it's costing $30 for me to put an ad in somebody's house in prime time. By the time you take all of those folks out, market agencies are very keen on this. And the advantage that the internet as a method has is that you can analyze and know exactly where your advertising dollars are going and what is working and what's not. So against all of those backgrounds, I think you're going to see more of a merge of these of the two technologies. It's not really one or the other. So I'm trying to think how do I say that as a research project for you, right? So why do some videos go viral? I think understanding and coming up with an analysis of why that happens, I think that would be very invaluable, because ultimately that's what's going to attract money, is what do people watch? If you've got their attention, if the eyeballs are sticky, you'll make money, and the channels will flow in that direction, the money will flow in that direction, the content will flow in that direction.
This is such a challenging research problem, right? If you were to, I mean, maybe you could do it experimentally, but the difficulty is that there's so many factors in a question like that, that how you would design something that would actually be able to make a claim about one versus another is really difficult.
Well, it may be probabilities, but at least if you knew all the factors and how much to weight each one in certain circumstances, I think that'd be very valuable work.
Yeah, so I do want to just, in a friendly way, object to the characterization that this talk doesn't have money in it, or that I'm not taking account of money, because it's all about money. I'm just talking about different money. Like, I'm talking about like distribution network money versus advertising money versus subscriber pay money. But there might be an interesting talk about, you know, the socialist YouTube, but that isn't this talk. Yeah.
But you were fishing for research projects, so I'm just throwing ideas at you.
Yeah.
Fascinating on all sorts of dimensions. I think one thing that I see that this question of transitioning from small and available to a relevant community, which doesn't play a role here in your story, to big and seen by anyone, mm-hmm. and whether there's that transition and whether that depends on edge caching, or whether it even needs any kind of a peer-to-peer framework, or whether that's included in the baseline hosting frameworks that we can relatively easily find, or particularly if you're not looking for stumble upon type people stumbling on you, but you actually are doing something for a community of interest. That's an important cultural component of the overall. It's an important story about the democratization of culture. And it's not clear that it's susceptible to the same scaling gap that you identify. And so trying to map that, I think, is important. And I don't know where your thinking is on that. I also think you're identifying three distinct, at least I could see three distinct kinds of research questions or projects. The first is about producers, which you described when you were saying, I tried to see what it would take me to put up on Amazon Web Services.
Yeah.
And I think on that, a study project that would look at video creators and musicians and seeing what it is that they're looking for. So if you look at Mimi Ito's work on AMV, on anime movie videos, they're not primarily on YouTube, and that's not primarily the relevant community. They don't care about it. The people who consume it don't care about it. There's a little bit of leakage, but they've created a cultural context. If you look at Slash video, here and there you get something leaking, and it's sensational because people really do that. Actually, that's not what people say. Wow, women really do that is what really gets people. But that's not a community that hasn't created for itself a cultural context that is on a larger scale and more easily accessible to broader people, maybe, as well as to intersections with broader culture, right? Just do Kirk Spock on Google and you'll find stuff you wouldn't have known 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that's one. So one aspect is looking at producer communities to see how hard is it for them to get to the audiences that are relevant to them. And then you need to step back, and it's not an empirical but a normative project of how important is that. Mm-hmm. Then there's the user question of how much of what it is that a user does see, hear, read that's not news. You excluded news. Come from non-mainstream or non-through the system of that requires capitalization for relevance. And for that, I suspect that the answer is something along the lines of the survey and following on the shoulder method, that you describe, but actually going and looking, what is the flow of streams that people catch, and then see how much of those are coming through these systems that require capitalization, and how much are not. And I don't know the answer to that, but that's a distinct question. And then only the third is this question of what is the ability to, I think it's parallel to the question of the network public sphere on the news side, of setting the agenda for what is broadly perceived as culture, which is that scaling problem to the several hundred thousand on YouTube that you're talking about. And in that regard, I think the research structure needs to be. What we're trying to do, let's say, with Media Cloud and looking at text analysis for agenda setting over time, or what Meme Tracker is trying to do with text, that is to say, identify some objective measure of high salience in a given moment of a given cultural good. Capture how it, when it became, see who it was, and then try to actually, at the minimum, start with case studies of, so the video, for example, the 890-some thousand viewers of the autistic kids, find 50 of those and see how they, I don't know whether it's of those, maybe it's of those. The point is identifying at least a large number of case studies of things that have emerged, maybe given during a given period, so that you actually have a sense of how many of these come from the periphery and how many come from the core, and look at those. But they strike me as three different aspects of the same problem you're looking at, and each requires a somewhat different set of methods.
Well, just to clarify, I mean, I think in some way the talk is a reaction against the first one that you identify. So the first one was, how do communities reach their desired audience of interest? And in some ways, I mean, I think there's a lot of valuable scholarship being done about, say, online video right now, but in some ways that's where it's focused. Like the YouTube Reader recently out is an interesting book, and it's got some very interesting chapters in it, but one thing is that it tends to act as though the scholarship, the biggest need in scholarship is to find examples of virtuous small communities and explain how they're arising. And it seems, in fact, that that's not the most interesting question. It's more the third that you identify, which is there a new gatekeeper or cultural industry configuration that's arising? Because not that the first isn't important, but rather that, you know, it seems that we all agree that these communities exist. I mean, there's a huge amount of work, particularly in the area of fans and remix culture, that you see just vast amounts written about.
Wouldn't you, at a minimum, need to resolve the second question of how important this is in the overall mix of some well-represented set of users, to see whether, in fact, the third question is the important one, or it's just the concern of the people who just can't see numbers below 100,000?
Right.
Right. Uh-huh. It's entirely possible. Imagine for a moment that the answer to number two were that 40% of the population spend 50% of their time on stuff that doesn't reach more than 100 people. The question of how important the third question is depends on the answer to the question of how important the second. And the question of how important the first is depends on how important the second. That is to say, have you seen, is if you, unless you're committed to calling it fragmentation, or calling it the death of journalism, or calling it whatever you want, which is clearly the position of the traditional media, but it's not at all clear that it's the right one from the perspective of somebody who's looking at the media ecology of the networked space.
I'm just going to say thank you.
So my understanding of Anita Elbersey at the business school, her take of the Chris Anderson question was that the web was actually magnifying the value of these blockbuster media. And looking that with respect to your talk and maybe breaking it down in terms of industry, I think that people in mainstream media might look and say that there's very little impetus to be revolutionized, just because there's things continue to sort of drift to that blockbuster size. And knowing people who make television their industry, where they just produce thing after thing after thing, with the TV networks or, you know, as independent filmmakers, I recall a conversation I was having with one of them, and they said, well, you know, you have to have this many thousand viewers just to recoup your costs. It doesn't make sense. So what's the impetus to change? What's, I guess I'm trying to understand it, because the money question someone else brought up, I
don't know. No, I mean, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, I didn't put Chris Anderson's name or on any of the citations because I don't think it's that useful a foil. Because if you look at the book, I hope he doesn't watch this, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't hold together as an argument, because many of the arguments he makes about why things are driving traffic or interest or companies down the tail, you could just as easily explain the opposite way, as I did with the recommender algorithm, but many other examples are similar. So I'm not familiar with the particular person you cited, but it actually seems quite consistent. Like when Merton writes about, you know, the 80-20 rule and Pareto distribution of citations, he says that, you know, it's feedback effects that push all this stuff up into the head, and you would expect them. So I'm not on the side of Chris Anderson or actually disagreeing with him either, because it's not worth engaging. But to your point, what's the incentive? I think some of the excited writers about television's transformation have forgotten, you know, institutions, and they don't recognize that there are these, as you point out, I'm again agreeing with you, there are these really large and powerful and well-financed institutions that have an investment in the way that things are now, and there is no equivalent Charlie Bit My Finger lobby or, you know, Chanimals agitators, right, that are, I mean, there's the beginnings in some way, like there's a small sort of civil society thing about open video standards, and there's some like beginnings of discussions that, you know, maybe we have to do something different with the distribution on the internet, but it's at the very nascent stage. So I mean, I'd like to see more of a counterpoint, to be honest. I mean, partly out of curiosity. I mean, I want to know what would come out in a different way. But you know, you're right. The impetus institutionally isn't there. And to be fair, you could say that, you know, you could explain sort of all media that way. You know, why a lot of user-produced media fits this analysis really well, and it's not actually that ever going to be that provocative. Like, why? What do people take pictures of with their camera back when they did that? They had a separate thing called a camera. It wasn't a phone. You know, what kinds of snapshots do they take? Well, they all take the same one. You know, it's the and you can see it on Flickr. It's this monument and them standing in front of it making the same face. So why does everyone want to have this same picture? Well, I mean, they're not revolutionizing the form. I mean, maybe some people are. Maybe it's a recall device, of course, obviously. But, you know, that again, there, in many elements of user-produced content, you don't see anything that revolutionary, and nor would you expect to. So the answer, I mean, I guess I'm agreeing with you in saying it may be that I was naive to expect revolution, or maybe Amanda Lotz was. I don't know.
But I really liked the Amanda Lotz's book. But if you killed the edge cache problem, how is it that everybody's not getting sort of exactly what they want?
Well, okay, let's kill it. I mean, it's alive and well. Like, you want to put Akamai out of business for me, I want to help. So,
okay.
Yeah, but you know, it's not clear how to do that, right?
I mean, I'll get started.
In fact, the edge cache problem that you say, I mean, it actually has dimensions far beyond culture that are fascinating and really important that we don't really have a venue for here. But, I mean, the fact that it's so difficult and problematic to host your own content that you have to rely on this third-party tier is significant in many ways, not just culture, right? And so you kind of minimize that and say, well, once we solve that problem, but let's solve it. Like, that's a really important problem. I mean, and there have been some interesting efforts that direction, like CoralNet, I guess. But it's, you know, it's just at the beginning stages, right? I mean, if you didn't need these intermediaries, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I need an intermediary now. It's not just distribution. It's also, you know, protection from denial of service attacks. You know, there's geographic elements to the internet infrastructure. There's a bunch of different reasons. So this is actually a big problem. I'd love to solve it, and I would go home happy.
Thank you very much.